From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Director Barry Jenkins' adaptation of If Beale Street Could Talk is nominated for 3 Oscars. It's based on James Baldwin's novel, pitting the tender love of a young couple against a pitiless miscarriage of justice.
You ready for this?
I've never been more ready for anything in my whole life. You know I love you, no matter what happens.
That film, like the 2016 documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, brings Baldwin's sharp observations to new audiences. So does a recently discovered series of letters written during Baldwin's 1957 tour of the American South, revealing his unfiltered observations of Black life in the early years of the Civil Rights Movement. Author Ed Pavlik wrote a series of essays on Baldwin's tour for Brick Magazine. He's a professor of English and African American Studies at the University of Georgia and joining us from Athens. Hello, Ed.
Hello there.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very well. Excited to read about this. A lot of things that I didn't know about Baldwin. We know he grew up in Harlem, but was living as an expat in Paris for nearly a decade, then 1957, when he came back and toured the American South. What brought him back?
Right. Well, gosh, it's an interesting story. For years, Baldwin would say that he was brought back to the United States while at a conference in Paris, he saw photographs in the newspaper of a young Black woman or girl, high school student nonetheless, named Dorothy Counts, walking to school amid a mob of white people who were jeering at her. And she was in the process of integrating Harding High School in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Baldwin said, you know, I saw that photograph and I'm over here in Paris. I've been over here kind of, you know, trying to improve my talent as a writer and make my career as an intellectual. And he said again and again how that picture just mobilized him to become politically involved in a way he couldn't have been in Paris and hadn't been thus far in his life. And that photograph drew him back to the United States to kind of take his place in a movement and do what he could on behalf of its goals. So, you know, the story is that James Baldwin was brought back to the United States with the intent on becoming part of the nascent civil rights movement or freedom movement, as it were. The interesting thing that I found is that it's impossible that that happened. And so, because Baldwin was actually misremembering some things years later when he devised that story, you know, which of course, it's a story that works very well. We can see a clear motivation and a clear path through history in that trajectory with that photograph, you know, as motivation. It's something we can all feel, we can all understand as we have to often in our media lives, you know, in a soundbite. The truth, of course, is more complex and a little bit murkier than that and far more mysterious than that. And I just think that Baldwin didn't have much interest in going into it in public, maybe even in private. Amid all the other things that were going on in his life in the 70s, you know, years later when he began to tell this story. But the fact is that Dorothy Counts made that walk famously in early September of 1957. But Baldwin was actually at that conference where he says he saw the picture in 1956. Hmm. And so the picture was actually didn't exist when he was in the position to see it, as he said he was. By the time the picture did exist, he was already in New York with his plane ticket to D.C. and on his way to the South. And so that was really the main question when I was looking at this stuff in detail. One of the main questions was, okay, you know, if it wasn't the photograph of Dorothy Counts that brought him back here, what did do it? And like I say, that answer is a little bit harder to encapsulate in a soundbite. But if I had to do that, maybe I could say that, you know, in the 1950s, the role of a writer, the role of a literary artist, was a very solitary endeavor. And as was in ways, American life in mainstream terms in the 1950s was kind of it was the decade of private life. It was the decade of individual life in mainstream terms, you know, I think often propelled by a Cold War philosophy of the communist East being about collective things and social groups, and our democratic way in the free world was about individuals emancipated to do their own bidding, you know, with their own self-interest in mind. Okay, can you follow that?
I can, yes. But I want to cut in here so that we can get to some of the things that are actually on the trip. I mean, what you're talking about is, you're talking about the layers and subtext and all of the things that motivated James Baldwin, and I think that that is really important stuff, and I know that's part of the topic of your essay, but I'm also interested in knowing actually the mechanics of this trip. Now, this was 1957. He was on assignment for the magazine Partisan Review, and probably like a lot of people, were motivated by those photographs that we saw of the indignities that African Americans were treated to, or exposed to at that time. But he'd never been to the American South at that time. He'd written prolifically about race and class. We have Go Tell It on the Mountain was a hit, and Notes of a Native Son. But we learn about his thoughts and feelings during this tour, including a meeting that he had in Charlotte. This was with Gus Roberts. This is a man who became the first Black student to graduate from an integrated school in Charlotte. Met with him, and his family made a deep impression. So how does he describe that in his letters?
So, you know, both of James Baldwin's parents were Southerners, born and raised in the American South, in New Orleans and in Maryland. But he was born in Harlem and grew up in New York and found that hard enough, and then fled to Paris. And so he came back to the United States and quickly found himself on his way to, as you say, to the Deep South. And, you know, I think what he found there was a version of himself situated in American history in a way that he'd never had the experience in first person. You know, he had never felt these things. He'd never felt segregation by law in the way which was practiced in North Carolina. And then as he moved further south in Georgia, and then, of course, ultimately in Alabama, where he was for a couple weeks, he'd never had to smell and feel and taste what life was like under those kinds of circumstances. You know, and he, of course, in many ways, he had fled to France to even avoid the northern versions of those things, which were intense enough. And so he came back and went to Charlotte and met with the Roberts family. The father was at work that night, but he met with Gus Roberts and his sister and his mother. And he was, you know, looking for people who were, you know, they were activists. They were risking their lives to change the world around them. They were risking their lives to integrate these schools and, of course, you know, initiate changes which would be far more widespread than just the schools. And I don't know what he had in mind when he went there, but what he found was people who were just very, very circumspect about what they were seeing and feeling, and certainly about what they were saying to anyone, probably to each other and probably even to themselves, but certainly to him, you know, a Black man for sure, but a Northern journalist who had come from Paris and who knows where else, you know. So he comes to the Roberts house and he finds that people really aren't willing to answer his questions with much more than a word or two.
So they're playing it safe a little bit.
They're saying, they seem to be playing it very safe, but at the same time, in what they're doing, they're by no means playing it safe. You know, they're involving themselves in serious, lethal, and mortal risks. And Baldwin is, I think, kind of captivated, confused a little bit about how all that goes together. You know, how can people who are acting so meekly, you know, and avoiding aggressive postures in the way that they were obviously doing, even with him, how can people like that be wielding such dangerous historical power in the eyes of their fellow countrymen and the people around them in the city they live?
Their lives are on the line, but yet they're, you know, doing it sort of politely in some way. And this has struck me too. I mean, he's obviously not been there before. He knows so much intellectually about the experience of the South and experientially. But it's all based on impressions. And he's writing about visiting Atlanta later in a 1959 article. Didn't stay long in Atlanta, but found the city distinctly different in feeling than what he visited, for example, in Alabama. What was he noticing there?
Well, I think he was noticing something that anyone who comes and stays in Atlanta even today would notice readily, is that Atlanta's about it's about making money. You know? It's a commercial endeavor, Atlanta is, and interestingly had a certain idea about itself, even back then and even before then, as a city that was going to make its name as a commercial center and in ways that didn't want, you know, racial politics and protest politics to disrupt its image. And he basically Baldwin's apprehension of Atlanta at the time was that this was a city determined to not become Birmingham, you know, to not become a place
where
famous
they'd have
for fire hoses
right.
and police dogs and all of those things that we've known Alabama and certainly Birmingham, the images that we've known the city by. So Atlanta was trying to avoid all that, you know, and there are more nuanced things going on there, but that was the gist of it that struck him, and I think that's something that is important to think about when we think about the history of the city of Atlanta and even its contemporary, its life in the contemporary city of Atlanta.
Yeah. The old city that's too busy to hate, as
there
the
it is.
Saying
too busy
goes.
Making money to hate, right.
I'm speaking with the author and UGA professor Ed Pavlik about James Baldwin's tour through the South during 1957. He wrote an essay about a series of letters that were discovered and what they reveal, not just about the published work, but about James Baldwin's feelings and responses, including he met Martin Luther King for the first time in Atlanta. What was that encounter like?
Well, you know, again, Baldwin doesn't make too much of that, but he was struck by meeting King, and King was staying in a motel in Southwest Atlanta at the time. He was writing his first book at the time. He was he was in Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, and he was away from the family and his duties as a minister there to concentrate on the book, you know. And so Baldwin comes into his room there, and they have a brief conversation. I think Baldwin saw him as a middle-class young black man, you know, a Morehouse man that he was. And Baldwin came up rough in the Harlem ghetto, as he was so famous for saying, and never went near a university or a college until he was an adult and was a guest there, you know. And so I think he saw Martin Luther King as a Baptist preacher, an educated middle-class black man, kind of in a certain social file that Baldwin thought he recognized. And Baldwin was, I think it's important to realize that Baldwin was a kind of radical in a way that he wasn't well positioned to be enamored with Martin Luther King Jr. when they first met. He had all kinds of reasons, class-based reasons, religious reasons, to be suspicious of a man with that profile. But I think he sensed immediately there was something different about this one. And then, amazingly, a few weeks later, was able to go to a mass meeting at Dexter Avenue Church in Montgomery on a Monday evening. I saw King preach on Sunday and then went back for the mass meeting on Monday, and he was captivated by what he saw there. He had never seen anything like it. But Baldwin's own father was a Baptist preacher. Baldwin himself was a teenage Baptist preacher in Harlem. He thought he knew what happened in Baptist churches, and of course he did know very well what happened in black Baptist churches, but he said, I've never heard the kind of thing that's going on here in this church, at least in Montgomery, Alabama. There's a power here and a deep kind of human thing going on between these people in Alabama, and a lot of it has to do with their leader up there in the pulpit, Martin Luther King Jr. Something, you know, as the famous song from the 60s goes, something's happening here. He could feel that right away. And it would take him years to actually write about that in detail, but he could certainly feel it right away.
Right. And he didn't write about his trip to Birmingham until much later either. But this is, you know, the difference between what he is expressing in these letters that he's writing to his friend Mary Painter and to his brother and what is officially coming out reveal so much fear, apprehension. And near the end of the tour, he writes to Painter from a Birmingham hotel. Now, this is the source for the title of your article, Letter for a Birmingham Hotel. So what made this so significant for him and for you as a Baldwin scholar?
Well, you know, we all know as Americans, I hope we all know, and those who don't should soon find out all about Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from the Birmingham jail, of course, which became one of the primary documents of the modern civil rights movement, a letter that was written in 1963. And so, you know, as a writer myself, when I saw this letter on beautiful motel stationery from Birmingham that Baldwin had written in 1957, I thought, oh, my God, here's another letter from Birmingham, not a letter from the Birmingham jail, but the letter from the Birmingham motel. And it's kind of a playful twist on a very famous title. But the key thing there for me was that here in that letter, which is a brief letter written to a friend in the deep of night, on October 18th, 1957, you have a famous American writer and a person known to us now as a very seasoned political activist and a very tough person for sure. And at that moment that he's writing that letter from the motel in Birmingham, James Baldwin is absolutely at wit's end. He's having panic attacks. He has psychosomatic illnesses. He's absolutely, you know, coming apart at the seams from the pressure and the violence that's just in the air all around him and in the lives of the people that he's talking to, the black people he's talking to, and also some few white people that he's talking to who were white people in Birmingham who joined up with the movement or at least had publicly expressed sympathy for the movement, a solidarity with the movement, and were themselves encountering reprisals of all kinds in their lives. And so, you know, it's the portrait, a beautiful portrait of what it means for a artist, you know, a literary artist like James Baldwin, who has to live as literary artists and other artists have to live with all senses open. You know, you can't be an artist in the world and be successful if you're closed against the world around you. You have to be open to the world around you. And so Baldwin shows up into a place where it's just basically lethal to be that open to the world around you. And therefore, he absorbs a version of what was going on down there that was going to be really absorbed by no one who was really at work down there, because you couldn't have those two things. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, Baldwin's letter is just a priceless document about what an academic would call the phenomenology, what it really meant for the senses, what it meant to feel and see and hear that political and historical moment of our time.
Yeah, and the perspective
and
of
a
pretty
artist. Picture.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which
and not
is,
just any artist, you know, but arguably the most important African-American 20th century artist that we have. That he ended up there is kind of a miracle of our history and a great gift to us that we haven't quite, you know, we haven't been able to open yet because that letter, unlike King's, is so unknown to us.
Well, Ed Pavlik, I thank you for making it known to us, at least on the surface, but there's much more that the listeners can read in your article. We have a link to it at On Second Thought's website at gpbnews.org. And Ed Pavlik, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's great. Thank you. Thank you.
That's all we have time for today, but we will be back with more on Second Thought tomorrow morning at 9. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks for staying with us.